The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
It's back to school time, and today's civics lesson, boys and girls, is avoid being indicted on corruption charges. We saw that happen to a sitting member of Congress in Washington and a former top aide to the Reid administration in Atlanta. We'll look at the local implications from both of those events. Meanwhile, Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp are launching their general election battle. We'll check out the strategies. And there were allegations in a stunning new report from ProPublica about the influence of outsiders in the VA. Senator Johnny Isaacson of Georgia chairs the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. A lot more on all of that in a new edition of The Political Breakfast. You are cordially invited. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Joining me today, former Georgia Republican Party Chair Chuck Clay, now with the law firm of Hall Booth Smith, and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson, former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Welcome to you both.
Pleasure.
So apologies. Good to be here.
And we should mention Brian Robinson is sitting out this week. He's on a little vacation after things didn't go quite so well in the Casey Cagle campaign. Let's start with where we go from here with the survivors of that process. Chuck Clay, I'll start with you. Brian Kemp has perhaps the more challenging road ahead of him in terms of pivoting to the middle. We referred to this a little bit last time.
Right.
So far, he's just decided to paint Stacey Abrams as a radical, but sooner or later, he's going to have to define himself before the Democrats do.
I don't think the pivot is as much and as far as a lot of people sometimes seem to think. Yeah, he had the gun ad. Yes, he had some of these ads. But I've known.
And we'll see those again. I have a feeling, except by the other side, little clips of it.
Little things, just like Mr. Whatever it was dancing around with his fanny out, you know. I suspect we'll see that again, too.
Jason Spencer.
But no, I don't think it's this. Because Georgia fundamentally has never been a swing state between very, very liberal and very, very conservative. It's conservative right on occasion. Center-right, and we'll see if it's moving a little bit center-left. I don't think he has to pivot. I do think he has to shore up and go back out to particularly suburban women voters. He's got a lovely wife, three beautiful daughters, so it's not like he's it's on unfamiliar turf by any means. But I do think there's some areas that he can shore up there and tell his story about who and what he is. I think that the campaigns have already pretty much decided that in Kemp's case, it's an advantage now for him, which is he's going to be more comfortable for Georgians, not so much of who, where, and name and title, but I think just it's an easier fit. Nominee Abrams, outstanding, smart, tenacious, will be well-funded candidate. She's clearly, in my mind, decided that we're going to remake the Democratic Party and we're going to start now. And so she's not looking to convert. No, Kemp is looking to solidify and make sure that there is passion so his team goes out. She's out there to identify, recruit, register voters, and build a new Democratic Party, center-left. And I'm not speaking for her. That's my observation.
You know, historically, we've had very pragmatic governors in this state. And if you really go as far back as 2002, when Sonny Perdue was elected, let's state the facts. He was a sort of very pragmatic governor that really relied on the pulse and the guidance of the business community here in Georgia. The last two governors that we've had in the state has had a great working relationship with the business community. I think the one thing that Kemp is aware of, and he must be getting these suggestions, is if you continue to go down this very polarizing campaign rhetoric that we saw during the primary, and if you then replicate that in the general, it puts a lot of Georgia businesses at risk. We're still in the hunt right now, as we know, for Amazon. But when you have all of these headquarters that we have in Georgia, I just think that when you've had two pragmatic governors who, by the way, were Democrats first, and then they switched parties, and were able to appeal to a lot of these moderate Democrats because they'd known them for their mm-hmm. service while they were in the party. The one thing that I'm very happy to see that the Abrams campaign is doing is that the first shot was really fired at her, besides the RGA, the Republican Governors Association ad that we've seen on television now for 3 weeks plus, was a direct attack from the Kemp campaign, particularly around RFRA and mm-hmm. around
Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Right. And then there was, maybe a couple other sort of references by the Kemp campaign.
Yeah, and the Christmas ad directed at her finances.
Correct. So what she attempted to do, and I think that she has remained disciplined in this fact, is to say, you know, I want to talk about jobs. She talks about how she's visited 140 out of 159 counties around the state. Mm-hmm. To Chuck's point, she, unlike Kemp, I agree, is trying to solidify the votes because right now the way the current electorate currently stands, it definitely favors a Republican victory. But what the Abrams campaign is doing, and they're spending a lot of resources to do so, is that they're trying to expand that electorate, and they're trying to go after these sporadic voters who traditionally do not vote in gubernatorial elections.
A lot of them Democratic voters, presumably.
Yes.
But does she have to gain, pull some votes away from him in the middle because he is already using the R word, radical, just about every time he talks about her?
Yeah, I mean,
and that can define somebody in a hurry.
Well, the one good thing about the Abrams campaign is that her victory was so convincing against her former Democratic opponent, Stacey Evans, where I think that Georgians definitely had an opportunity to get to know her. The challenge is that when you then go from a primary campaign to a general election and you have the Republicans using the word like radical, even inferring that she's a socialist, comparing her to Hillary Clinton, talking about the George Soros money, talking about Nancy Pelosi. She now has the ability
Thank you.
I mean, I sound like a Republican consultant there.
You're right on all of them.
And yeah, but what I've been proud of, Dennis, is that she has had the money and the strategic plan in place to combat that. She's had a very good biographical ad up, but it does talk about jobs, it does talk about education, and it talks about healthcare. So what she's doing, which I think is very pragmatic in a sense, because she is a very intelligent campaigner, is that she's trying to really stay as focused as she can on the issues that matter most to Georgia, because what the Republican Party wants her to do, and I think Brian Kemp to a sense, is to talk about personal conduct and personal finances. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that both candidates have their issues with personal finances, and I'm sure the next time me and my good friend Chuck get together, we're going to discuss some of these personal finance issues that my good friend Brian Kemp has experienced over his long political career in Georgia. But the last thing I'll say is this.
But you're talking about the loans involving Affirming Kentucky and that
right.
sort of thing.
And so I think
meanwhile, Stacey Abrams mm-hmm. is hearing the charge that not only did she not pay more than $50,000 in taxes, which she is in the process of repaying, but while she was incurring that tax debt, she was loaning money to her own campaign.
Let me interject something on that, because I think most of us now, probably certainly in this room, the idea that just because there was financial issues, I don't think, given the reality of the last decade that we have all come through, there have been many, many fine businessmen and men and women who have had financial problems. It's got to be more than that to really cut. Now, I don't know any of the details. Sadly, mm-hmm. probably whether we want to or not, we will. My bottom line is I think she has a much bigger pivot and selling case to make to those middle-of-the-road voters than does Kemp, who is by no means, as an individual, he's one of the finest, kindest, non-polarizing individual I know.
Yeah, but I think that was what – we didn't see that, Chuck, my good friend, from his campaign, right? So I think that if you really compare the television ads and the radio ads and the mail pieces and the Facebook sponsor ads and the Instagram ads, if you pulled out all of those – as and compare them to what we saw from Abrams, I think there's a stark contrast between the polarization that was there. But I'm agreeing with you. I think that because we've historically had governors who are from the GOP in this state, he has a ability to really solidify a number of people who he knows is going to go ahead and vote for him. I think his pivot is harder, though, because his polarization not only made Georgia news, it made national news. And so at a time where we still see a little bit of this sort of campaigning I think his campaign would like to say more it's a comparison, a contrast. I think it's a little bit more of trying to really define Abrams before she can define herself. But my last point I want to make is this.
Yeah.
The one thing that's really interesting about Stacey Abrams is that she's been able to really utilize this national profile that she's built. But she's also
she was on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah
recently. But one thing that I think that she would want, you know, me to clarify is, yes, she did, like most Americans, have some decisions she had to make about her personal finances. If you listen to the attacks against her, it infers that she hasn't paid her taxes or nor has she filed them. And so one of the clarifications that I think that she made in her campaign was very strategic to do so is that this is a woman who has filed her taxes every single year. This is a woman who has paid her taxes every single year, and she's on a current payment plan to make sure that those taxes are paid. But the brilliant thing from the Kemp campaign was it said, okay, what's more important to you, Stacey Abrams? Is it paying Uncle Sam the money you owe him, or do you want to pursue your life dream of being the first African-American governor in our country? So I think that what she said was, I wanted to do both. I want to definitely make sure I clear up my taxes, and that's why I'm on a payment plan. But I also wanted to make sure that I had enough money to loan myself to run the effective campaign to get through the primary and maybe have a shot at being the governor of Georgia one day.
Well, I would just say, Theron knows as well as I do, as you do, Dennis, the kabuki of politics versus the reality of politics. And so there's a lot of posturing. You will see ads, I'm sure, on the finances of both. And if there's something egregious, it's a legitimate issue. But the bottom line is the Kemp place is the easier, more comfortable, most likely way to expand your numbers on existing voting patterns.
Do you think either of you that attacking each other on their finances will in the end matter? Because most folks in Georgia want to know, as we hear so often, what are you going to do about jobs? What are you going to do about health care? What are you going to do about rural poverty? Those
kinds of things.
Well,
look, if somebody's a crook and they've been illegal or even unethically using their position to beg, borrow, take, steal, hurt folks in the process, that's one thing. If somebody during the recession hit some difficult times, okay, debate it back and forth and see. It's, of course, in a degree. If it's egregious and it really goes to your fundamental ethics and acumen, it ought to be an issue.
It's a good way to force your opponent's campaign to be distracted with an issue that, quite frankly, the American people didn't really care about. We have a president in the White House right now who has filed bankruptcy at least five times, who has yet to release his tax returns. So if he can become the president of the United States of America, I think that Brian Kemp or Stacey Abrams can definitely be the governor of Georgia. But it does raise a credibility issue, and it also speaks to how you manage your personal finances and how will you manage the state's budget.
Very quickly, I want to get quick takes from both of you on this. Is there anything at all to learn in terms not just of the gubernatorial race, but perhaps congressional races here, from those recent primaries and the special election in Ohio, those contests in other states in which there were close primaries on the Republican side, in Kansas, for instance, that very close special election for Congress in Ohio. But is there anything from those states that applies here as we move into November?
I'm always a little bit wary about extrapolating too much from what happens elsewhere to any one particular state. Obviously, home for us is Georgia. I don't know all the details, and I don't think those Georgians who are going to vote next November have a clue or care. Do I think, however, can you draw some conclusions? Well, my first is a win is a win is a win. I've had some close ones. I've had some lopsided ones. I have some losers. But a win is a win. Are there signs that the Republicans out there, it seemed to me there is a factor where maybe, and I mentioned that here, is with women voters to a degree, they need to do some work to expand or solidify or bring back or ensure that base and then turn out their strongest supporters.
If you were Karen Handel in the 6th District or Rob Woodall in the 7th District, Republican incumbent members of Congress, and you're looking toward the national Republicans for help in these demographically changing districts, would you be worried?
I don't think they need to be worried. Is it an issue that can cause worry? Yes. And it's a fine line. Trump has shown his magnetic ability, obviously, in this race right here, in the governor's race. At the same time, there are other aspects that are really local issues that they, I think they need a little bit of distance because everybody is unique.
A few correlations about what happened in Ohio that I think we can see replicated here in Georgia. Number one, the person who doesn't get a lot of credit or has not gotten a lot of credit for winning that race for the Republican is Governor Kasich, who was a very popular governor.
This was his old district.
This was his old district.
Redrawn a little bit, but still
redrawn a little bit. His old district. He came out and endorsed a Republican candidate. In Georgia, we have a very popular governor who who talks about criminal justice reform, which is something that 2 years ago or 3 years ago, the Republican Party in Georgia would have crucified him for wanting to do something about criminal justice reform and transit. The other thing that's very striking to me about Ohio is that this was an 80% Republican district. And so for a Democrat to come that close, it showed you that they were able to basically pull Republicans away from the GOP. And it was centered around a referendum on Trump. And I think what President Trump has done very well in the last few elections is that he's really depending on his campaign team and his polling to make sure that he's not entering these races that he doesn't necessarily feel that he can win. The last thing I'm looking at in that district is if the Democrat had won in that district, Dennis, my narrative, my speaking to you today would be totally different. I would be telling you a blue wave is getting higher and higher and it's on its way to Georgia. That loss did give the Democratic Party nationally an opportunity to say, hey, look at what we were able to gain, but it still wasn't the victory we needed to go into the midterm elections.
But if you're Democrats, do you say, okay, the Republicans can't defend every district in November? If you're the Democrats, do you get behind the challengers, especially in the 7th and the 6th, in hopes of flipping them, or do you say, okay, not yet?
I agree with Chuck. I think that if you look at Republican voters in Ohio or moderate independent voters in Ohio, they're way different than these voters that are in District 6 and 7. But the difference is this. We know, particularly in District 7, more so than 6, is that you've had a huge demographic increase there. And you look at what Carolyn Bordeaux was able to do as a woman. You look at what Lucia Macbeth was able to do as a woman who's this challenger to
Karen Handel.
And Carolyn Bordeaux is a challenger, Democrat challenger to Rob Woodall. So I think that traditionally, the Reaganist sort of compassionate conservative voter who still lives in Georgia is not that many of them anymore because I think Trump has did his best to try to destroy that particular part of the party. I think that they are still motivated to go out and support the Republican candidate. What Carolyn Bordeaux and Lucy Macbeth has got to do is figure out a way to have a Georgia-specific message to appeal to some of these suburban, college-educated, disaffected Republican women who we saw switch their vote in Ohio and voted for the Democrat or the Green Party sort of candidate.
And you do. You can't win it just unless you have the candidates. And there's clearly they're drawing now, the Democrats, better candidates up and down. Now, you know, this idea that some Republican or from Atlanta is going to beat John Lewis, that's absurd. Or probably any Democrat's going to win in the
sixth. Anybody against Jody Heiss, for instance.
For instance. Yeah. So, I mean, there's those realities, but you have to do better. But I do want to say one thing, because I know sometimes we get put on a side of issues. But I would say after 135 years of Democrat leadership in this state, there wasn't an ounce of consideration for justice reform or penal reform, and I know it because I passed the public defender bill. That was my legislation that was signed by Sonny Perdue, and Nathan has picked it up and done even better over time. I hope that's a bipartisan issue, not a partisan one.
And there is more to come from the kitchen on this Political Breakfast podcast. Stay with us.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
You love free. And at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And we are back on this edition of The Political Breakfast. Thanks for being with us. Former Georgia Republican Party Chair Chuck Clay, now with the law firm of Hall Booth Smith, is with us, along with Democratic strategist Theron Johnson, former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. A couple of very quick things. Is there going to be any ripple? And Chuck Clay, I'll start with you. From the indictment of New York Congressman Chris Collins on insider trading charges, the pharmaceutical firm, the stock of the pharmaceutical firm that was involved here, was also held by Tom Price, former congressman from your neck of the woods, former Health and Human Services Secretary, who was questioned about some of his investments and stock trading during his confirmation process. Now, there's nothing to indicate that that what happened to Chris Collins will happen to him. But just because of that local connection, is there any kind of political fallout for Republicans, particularly in the northern suburbs here?
I think it's too obtuse and too far away, and I don't think there's time between now and November for that really to unfold. There's certainly nothing unique about investing. I mean, there's nothing unique about companies coming up short. I don't know anything about the details of insider trading. That's certainly a New England Wall Street business side significant issue, as insider trading always has been and should be. There's nothing more violative of an even playing field than somebody being able to manipulate inside information to cover their losses or potential losses or send it to friends. So it can be, if it just really, the network really gets out to a level where this is far more expansive than this guy and wanting to protect his family illegally, if it's true, then let the chips fall. I don't see it playing here terribly.
This is very unfortunate for all of us as Americans, and this is definitely not something that the GOP definitely want to be discussing. And more importantly, it's really sort of sad in regards to former Congressman Price, who is a person who many of us have grown to just respect and think that he did a good job serving our state as a member of Congress. And so to have this information now come out and to let us not forget what the unfortunate occurrence that happened to him while serving in the Trump administration, where he had to unfortunately resign, this just sort of, to me, amplifies this sort of culture that I think has kind of been created with Trump and his presidency. It begs me to want to think, like, is there really proper vetting going on with these members of Congress and these people who actually go on to try to serve in the administration? So I do believe in being innocent until proven guilty. This definitely doesn't pass the smell test. It definitely looks a little murky. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's just something that Congressman Price and the Republicans have just got to continue to try to be as transparent as they can with the American people.
I don't think we get down to a point where Republicans are going to be voting on what did or did not happen to a former congressman. I'm going to trust that Tom Price is absolutely up front with his dealings, always has been for the man I know. But that's a Tom Price issue and a Washington issue.
Meanwhile, here in Atlanta, the former deputy chief of staff to Mayor Reed, Katrina Taylor Parks, was indicted on charges of accepting a bribe from an unnamed city contractor. Theron, this one just keeps spreading as Mayor Bottoms tries to work her administration clear of having to talk about it. You know, obviously the question is, what are the implications for former Mayor Reed?
Katrina Taylor Parks is a 20-plus year veteran at City Hall, who I met back in my early days of starting in city politics, and to everything that I've known about her, was always above board and a very honorable woman. But unfortunately, this charge is very serious. It is something that I think is going to cast a cloud over Reed's legacy, unfortunately. I think that, to be fair, you're innocent until proven guilty in this country. There's no implications that Mayor Reed knowingly did anything wrong in this case or that he was involved. But the other unfortunate thing is that we have our great mayor and Keisha Lance Bottoms, who's doing her best every single day to lead this city. And I thought that her statement that she released by saying that Katrina Taylor Park's service to the city was a direct stark contrast in what these allegations and these charges are stating that she allegedly did. The other thing that really just stuck out to me, Dennis, is that no one should take a bribe, whether it's for $4,000, $40,000, or $4 million. And so that is just illegal and it's wrong. But the thing that was really interesting to me, and as this continues to unfold, is that we're looking at, I guess, two payments that were made in the sums of $2,000 to her and a company that she operated, and then allegedly a $2,000 payment to her husband, and to, I guess, affiliated with the company as well. I just find it very hard to believe that a veteran and who has served the city in many capacities would jeopardize her long career and her reputation and her family's reputation with a payment less than 2% of her overall strategy that she was making at the city. So I think that in this case, this is the first one that you've really been able to tie it to a high-level executive who worked into the very end.
Actually briefly into the Bottoms administration.
And briefly into the, and so for the, also for the record, is that she was out on FMLA leave, and she was able to retire from the city of Atlanta before these charges were filed. And so, again, it's not something that I know that Mayor Bottoms stands for. I know she wants to be as transparent as she possibly can while serving as mayor. I do believe that in this country you're innocent until proven guilty, but these are serious charges, and I think that Katrina is going to take them very seriously, and hopefully we'll just let the justice system play itself out.
I don't want to comment on any facts or details. I don't want to see corruption anywhere, and you're right. The system needs to work out. But I would remind you, on our watch in the Fulton County Commission office a number of years ago, for about a similar amount of money, somebody put their life and career in jeopardy and have paid the price and moved on and doing well. But it's amazing what people can do, will do, and we can't explain it. But to me, the bigger issue is plain and simple. If Trump's got Russiagate and that hurts in D.C., well, there's always a problem in these types of corruption things that hover over Atlanta. That's a whole lot closer than the Australian drug company that went down and under. So, yes, it does have a somewhat of a pall, if you cast a pall, if you will, on that side of things. I hope it all clears itself up. I hope nobody innocent gets hurt, but it will be part of a campaign issue come fall.
Yeah, but let me just clear up something about how Trump is handling this Mueller investigation and Russia investigation. You will never see Mayor Bottoms go out and say some of the things about this investigation that Donald Trump's done. She would never go out and suggest that the attorney general for Georgia or a city attorney should dismiss these charges, or to try to deflect and criticize Mueller.
And if I intimate
and hold on, and then to try to also get deputy attorneys fired. And so, Chuck, I have to push back on you with that one. While there are two investigations going on, and I think the one that's been going on with Trump is a little bit more robust than the one that's going on in the city.
Well, the one
right
that's
now.
Here is a lot closer to home, and that's the problem. Closer to home.
But I think the biggest difference is, and I want to clear this up because I know Mayor Bottoms and her staff and supporters listen to our podcast. It is a stark contrast about how she has cooperated. She has turned over information, Dennis. Paper after paper, open records after open records. These agencies, WABE, AJC, all the news networks, they can't hire enough people to go through all this information that this mayor has turned over. She's been cooperative. She's been ethical. And so I think to make that comparison to Trump, it's just really laughable in this case because—
We'll see. let me make sure that if I intimated anything on the part of this mayor, I don't. That was not my intent. I'm talking about just the pall, and I don't envy her. I wish her best.
Very quickly, in addition to this, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen revelations that the settlement terms between Mayor Reed and Miguel Southwell, the general manager at the time of the airport, that those were not exactly disclosed to city council in terms of exactly what they were. Meanwhile, the bonuses that Mayor Reed paid out as he was leaving were found to be in violation of state law and perhaps the city charter. So, Theron, this is a man who really would, one would think, like to take a rest and perhaps get back into the political arena. What does all this do to his chances of doing that?
You know, it's challenging for him. And, for those of us who know him, I know Chuck has mm-hmm. served with him. Dennis, you've interviewed him mm-hmm. many times.
Many times.
And look, I ran his campaign in 2009 mm-hmm. and served 1 year in his administration. I was very grateful of him giving me an opportunity to run his campaign. I just think that the unfortunate thing about all these decisions that he was a part of, obviously, is is going to unfortunately cast this negative narrative over his long legacy that I think that if you really look back on his years of service in the city of Atlanta, you know, he's going to go down in history from his ability to deliver results for the city as one of our best mayors. But the other thing about the undisclosed payment, you know, it's a lot of people that are being just criticized in this. You know, you have Miguel Softwell, who was terminated, and it's never come out whether or not there was any improper, without cause sort of measure in his termination.
But there was going to be a legal battle about it.
There was definitely going to be a legal battle. He pushed back. So, you know, Mayor Reed and his attorney, him being Softwell, and the city's attorney had a public settlement. And then there's this unknown settlement that no one knows who paid for. And it just implicates, and it just seems like there was just some type of cover-up. And then to fast forward to the bonuses, at a time where I know Mayor Reed wanted to reward many of these cabinet-level positions, people who served in these positions, with bonuses for helping him leave upwards of $220 million in the reserves for the city of Atlanta. He wanted to reward them for their outstanding hard work, but it clearly was not probably the best legal way to do it, and that's come out with this independent investigation that Mayor Bottoms actually authorized for somebody to look into it. So, you know, again, I think that this mayor has just got to work through these challenges and try to work with council to get the city and continue to make sure the city is on the right track.
Real quickly, Chuck Clay, you've watched campaigns and candidates for a long time. Does this hurt Kasim Reed's political future in the long run?
Sure it does, both short term. We don't know long term. There's a whole lot, and the details and my experience with Kasim, like everybody, has been nothing but a pleasure. Whether there was wrongdoing, I hope not. And Theron's 100% correct. There's not more than I can add, but certainly it puts a cloud over. Certainly it would make it tough in the short term. It may or may not in the long term.
Very quickly to wrap up, ProPublica this week came out with a story that said three friends of President Trump, including Ike Perlmutter, the chairman of Marvel Entertainment, are closely involved with decisions at the Veterans Administration, not just advising, which can happen anytime, but actually summoning officials down there, talking to them, weighing in on decisions about public versus private care, for instance, personnel. None of them has any military experience, and according to the ProPublica piece, this has all been done in secret. Senator Johnny Isaacson of Georgia is the chair of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. We got a statement just recently from his spokeswoman, Amanda Maddox, who says, Senator Isaacson cannot confirm the accuracy of the story. He is aware of the individuals mentioned in the story and has concerns about the effect that outside individuals have had on the VA. He has not interacted with any of them, and he has not spoken to the president about this story. It's hard to astonish political reporters, but if this one is true, and we don't know yet, but if ProPublica is right here, this is absolutely astonishing.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because, you know, you want to believe that President Trump, and I do believe this, that I think that he genuinely cares about our veterans who go serve our country, men and women who put their lives on the line to protect us and defend this country. And when they come home, they should have the opportunity to receive the best health care, the best assistance to make sure that they can go on and live a quality life. But the whole thing about President Trump going to Mar-a-Lago, I mean, we know the amount of money that taxpayers spend to fly him down there all of last year and this year, and we never really knew the conversations that were going on. And so, again, this is still an allegation. This is still a report that has not been confirmed, but it's just not how you deal with this, and it's really put Senator Isaacson in a very tough position, who I know that deep down in his heart wants to continue to serve these veterans. He wants to support this president.
And he's been working on VA reform for a long time.
For a very long time.
Chuck Clay, you've known Johnny Isaacson for years and years. Does it surprise you, it must, to think that these folks have not even talked to Senator Isaacson?
Well, obviously, we all know Johnny's of absolute impeccable both character, ethics, principles, and devotion to service. Am I surprised if this true? This is so amorphous and so kind of, this doesn't match up. How do you have private people impacting a enormous entity? I don't know what that means. Is it advisory? Is it pecuniary? Is it financial? I hope none of the above. And it's certainly not unusual for presidents to travel or have informal talks and advisors. If the motives
the
are self-promoting.
The here was, though, that these guys were practically running the show.
Well, if there's allegations and proof that ultimately somehow they are profiting by their positions outside of government and controlling, inputting, or otherwise having anything to do with policy of a governmental entity, then heads need to roll.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Joining me today, former Georgia Republican Party Chair Chuck Clay, now with the law firm of Hall Booth Smith, and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson, former National Southern Regional Director of the Obama 2012 campaign. Brian Robinson taking a little time off after his work as a paid consultant to the Casey Cagle campaign. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Dennis. Always good to see you.
We'll do it. And Theron, have a good trip.
And if you like this show, subscribe. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure other people can find us. We will be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.